From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, miracles. Here's what's happening. As Californians were forced to once again confront the dual threats of wildfires and forced blackouts, the apparent new normal is proving to be too much for some residents. Now, the nation's largest utility company, Pacific Gas and Electric, will turn off the power for a third time this year to prevent powerful winds from damaging its equipment, which can lead to a blaze igniting. Up to 605,000 customers, that's about 1.5 million people, in 29 Northern California counties will be affected by the latest round of power cuts, which started today. That means people who had the power go out on Saturday and were still getting the lights back on Monday are now faced with the prospect of being in the dark again for several days. My gosh. And California's recent power shutoffs, meant to reduce the risk of potentially catastrophic fires, have had an unwelcome side effect. The blackouts have also cut power to many cell phone towers, blocking the main communication source for many in harm's way. Let's check in with our expert on such matters, Lauren Weinstein. This is a serious situation, Lauren.
Let's check the date. We're well into the 21st century, and we can't keep the power on. It's as if we were a third world country in the 20th century. The power companies are blacking out millions of people now. Many of those people have medical conditions. They're dependent on power. They don't have easy transportation to leave. But the executives of those companies, their salaries are great. So they're paid while the grid rots away. And the same kind of situation is why this relates to the cell sites going out. Because of deregulation, the minimum is done to provide backup power for those cell sites. There's a little bit of battery time. Sometimes there are generators. But if there's a fire, they can't get to the cell sites to provide fuel for the generators. There was a time when AT&T, back in the Bell System days, they were so proud of their commitment to reliable service, provisioning services to stay up in natural disasters and emergencies. You can go to YouTube and you can find films that they produced explaining and bragging, really, they were so proud of their public service attitude. Now they deregulated, just an excuse to raise rates, do the minimum service necessary. In many areas, many of the large telephone companies have ripped out all their old copper telephone circuits, which provided the most reliable service.
Oh, yeah, all the old landlines. Goodbye.
The POTS landlines, they're powered from the central office, so they are essentially immune to the kinds of power cuts we're talking about now. I recommend that anyone who can still get them get at least one landline in your home. A copper landline, because the first things that go down when there's a natural disaster or other kinds of emergencies, the cell sites go down, the cable systems go down, the internet goes down. You don't want to be left that way.
You got it.
And the thing that is just so irritating about this is there have been attempts to pass regulations and laws to require reasonable backups for these systems, maybe 8 hours of power, things like that. And you can guess how the big companies have reacted to that, the big telephone companies. They've fought them tooth and nail. That's how we ended up where we are now.
What a disaster. Lauren, thanks. Always appreciate your input. President Trump has again blamed the Federal Reserve for holding back the economy, saying the U.S. has unlimited potential. He says the Fed doesn't have a clue, he tweeted, as U.S. policymakers began the first of a two-day meeting. A top advisor to President Donald Trump on Ukraine testified that after listening to Mr. Trump ask Ukraine's president to investigate a domestic political rival, Joe Biden, he was so alarmed that he reported the matter to a White House lawyer out of concern for U.S. national security. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis about all of this. It looks like the House is going to take this to television, John, but give me your overview.
Okay. My overview is this, George, that the act itself of twisting somebody's arm as a president, as a secretary of state, as anybody in the government with respect to anyone who receives money, foreign aid from or military aid, whether it's for humanitarian reasons or for military reasons, any U.S. official can strong arm any foreign leader to comply with what it is that the country wants out of the holding those purse strings and giving that cash to those countries. So the premise that bullying or twisting somebody's arm or applying coercion or pressure on a foreign leader is an impeachable offense is preposterous. It's ridiculous. It happens every day. How many years have you heard that if the Israelis, if Netanyahu doesn't do this or doesn't do that, they're going to cut military aid, they're going to cut humanitarian aid to Israel? It happens all the time. So the dog and pony show that's going on right now in Congress, behind closed doors, I might add, with Adam Schiff at the head, interviewing all these people and getting precisely exactly what they want out of these witnesses is not going to hold up in any kind of a trial. It's not going to hold up anywhere. There's no alternative witnesses. There's no cross-examination. Republicans are entirely, essentially excluded from the entire process. So they're building a case against Trump that is on a stack of cards, that is like cotton candy. Any prosecutor can tear this case apart. But the basic premise of the case, that the President of the United States has engaged in a high crime and misdemeanor because he asked a foreign leader about potential corruption that went on in the Ukraine that involved a one among 20 presidential candidates' son, mainly focused on his son, Hunter, receiving in excess of $150,000 a month for a four-year period. And that was just in Ukraine, not to mention the $1.5 billion he walked away with in China because his father was vice president. And you know that liberal press is in trouble when they start running stories after this is brought up about the Bidens, when they're starting to talk about Ivanka's dealings and Donald Trump Jr.'s dealings and this and that. They know that whatever case they've built against Trump, they couldn't get him on obstruction. They couldn't get him on Russian collusion. Their plan all along was to have a strategy to impeach him, to guarantee the best shot they could at besmirching his approval ratings as much as possible before the election to give their candidate the best shot of winning in 2020. So if you want a big picture of really what's gone on, this is a continuation of the Russian hoax that kind of blew up in their face. There was the obstruction hoax that they couldn't really do anything with. And now suddenly a whistleblower who really isn't a whistleblower, they're a whistleblower like Edward Snowden was a whistleblower, or like Chelsea Manning was a whistleblower. These are people, basically partisans, who are snooping and snitching out to get Trump because it's the inside of the FBI that decided, the Strokes and the Lisa Pages, that somehow Trump shouldn't be president. So we're going to do everything we can possible within the FBI at our disposal in the intelligence community to sabotage his presidential campaign.
This election in 2020 is going to be very interesting. John, thanks, and appreciate your debate with Howard Bloom that we had last week. A vaccine which could revolutionize tuberculosis treatment has been unveiled by researchers. Now, it's hoped the vaccine will provide long-term protection against this disease, which kills 1.5 million people around the world each year. The highly contagious disease is caused by bacteria, and the current vaccine is not very effective at all. Anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen and aspirin can battle major depression effectively and could be a safer alternative than antidepressants, according to a new study. Just remember that, folks. Up next, we're going to talk about when the Earth had two moons, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Professor Eric Espog, back with us. It was last with me about 8 years ago. World-renowned lunar and planetary laboratory expert at the University of Arizona, Tucson. Previously, he was the Ronald Greeley Chairperson of Planetary Sciences at Arizona State University, Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Santa Cruz as well. The first mission he worked on was the Galileo, the flagship that had been launched when he was teaching high school and was approaching the Jupiter system when he started his postdoctorate at NASA. He has since been on the science teams of several past and present missions to the moon and minor planets as well. Eric, welcome back. Has it really been 8 years?
You know, I was trying to remember, George, and I remember that phone call really well and enjoy your show a lot.
Thank you.
And I guess it has been 8 years. It's a good thing we don't get any older.
My gosh, you're right. And let's not let eight more years go by after this before we get you back on again, Eric.
Agreed.
Great book, Earth Had Two Moons. Fascinating. I mean, I couldn't put it down. Interesting theory. Let's first of all talk a little bit about what's going on in the world of science, and we'll get into your work in a very big way here. Anything revolutionary going on these days?
Well, you know, we're at this point where we've the Industrial Revolution has kind of led to bigger and bigger telescopes, you know, like the gravity wave monitors and space telescopes that are bigger than your house. And, you know, so we're like at this cusp. It's very interesting. You know, we're at this point where we're starting to observe things that we've never seen before. And, you know, and it sparks the curiosity because we're not really, you know, our brains aren't wired to handle a lot of change with reality year by year. But I guess the biggest news is just all the planets that we know of. Something like 4,000 of them now.
Are you a believer in life out there?
I am. I am, actually.
Good.
Yeah.
How about that they visited us?
Where
do you stand
there? Well,
there,
I'm as a scientist, my day job is to be a skeptic.
Okay.
And
nothing
and
wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, because if there weren't skeptics, you'd never know what the truth was, right? It's like if a defendant, if the murderer doesn't have a good lawyer, you won't know for sure that he was a murderer, right?
But lots of strange things going on up there, Eric.
You know, I check it all out. I mean, not all of it. The Nimitz videos.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Yeah. These are quite interesting to me. And you know, I should say that the response of scientists is usually either a knee-jerk reaction to discount all of that, you know, and say that it always turns out to be something else, which usually is the case. Most things do turn out to be something else. But then the other side, you're starting to see more and more scientists look at these things with a little bit of an open eye. You know, for example, the Nimitz videos from the fighter jets,
mm-hmm.
and then this asteroid Oumuamua, the interstellar,
yeah, whatever it is,
whatever that is, and you have people like the chairman of astronomy at Harvard University writing a serious paper on that this thing could have been a piece of an alien spaceship,
which is fascinating, and they call it a Dyson sphere, and God, who knows what this thing could be. It's probably a big old space rock, but you know what? The imagination does wonders, doesn't it?
It does.
Now, the title of this book, of course, is When the Earth Had Two Moons, which tells me that you think we had two moons. What happened?
Well, it's kind of an evocative title. You know, it's meant to sell books.
Well, you're doing a good job with that.
And the notion of two moons, we had this theory that we published, in 2011, I guess it was, and thinking it's still an unsolved mystery. Why does the moon have two sides? We have the near side that everybody stares at every night, except for tonight. It's a new moon. You can only see you can just barely see the little crescent.
Exactly.
You know, people were observing it. And but the man in the moon, the bunny, rabbit in the moon, whatever you call it, from whatever culture, these are all big lava flows that have filled in all these low basins, and it's all this dark basalt all over the near side. And then in 1959 was the first time humans had ever seen the far side, thanks to a robotic mission sent by the Russians in 1959, the Luna 3 mission. And
So you don't see any of that stuff. You just see high mountains. And then subsequent missions showed that the far side of the moon, the crust is about 20 miles thicker than the crust is on the near side. And so we came up with kind of a, you know, it's kind of a crazy idea, but all the pieces fit together really well, that the moon is actually two moons that collided, and one of the moons splatted against the other, kind of like two snowballs splatted together.
Is the second moon totally encompassed by the first moon, or did it parts of these fragments fly off into space somewhere?
It would be kind of like a pie in the face. The physics is about the exact same physics. Well, it's kind of funny because you think about things as one thing hits another in planetary science, and you're supposed to think, I'm going to make an impact crater, or I'm going to demolish it. But here, if you have two moons orbiting around the Earth and they actually do collide, which basically means their orbits went unstable and they got in trouble and they hit each other, you know, these collisional velocities are pretty slow. And so it's kind of like a big landslide or a big car, you know, pileup. It's just all this. So the second moon just kind of flattens like a pancake and becomes the Far Side Highlands. It becomes all those mountains. And so in our theory, the far side of the moon really is this other moon, flattened out and splatted into place.
What would happen to planet Earth if we didn't have a moon at all?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the most significant effect would be, apart from the fact that the impact, we think a giant impact made the moon. There's a lot of evidence for that. And then that probably set the stage for the Earth being the kind of planet that it is. So the moon being, you know, part of the formation process of the Earth could be part of what it makes to have a planet that ticks the way that ours ticks. You know, it has plate tectonics, it has ocean basins that open up, it has this certain composition and certain amount of water. We don't know the answer to that for sure, but we do know we can play the thought experiment, take the moon away, just go pick it up, put it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Now what does the Earth do? The Earth's axis is no longer stabilized. You can think of the moon as kind of like a cam wheel or something, you know, something that sort of stabilizes the rotation. And if you took the moon away, the Earth would actually have seasons that would point all over the place. Instead of pointing, you know, the Earth's axis is 23.5 degrees from due north, and that gives us spring, summer, winter, and fall as we go around the sun. It, you know, the north points towards the sun in the summer, the north points away from the sun in the northern winter. You might have times where the North Pole points directly at the sun, and the equator of the Earth could become the cold part.
We'd also lose that gorgeous full moon, wouldn't we?
We'd have a...
My gosh.
I think when I said there was like a little crescent moon tonight, I'll bet you, you know, like a third of the listeners probably saw it. And, you know, for me, that's the thing that's amazing about the moon, is that everybody has some kind of a relationship with the moon. We've seen it since we were babies.
Uh-huh.
It's something that's always up there. If you're having your worst day ever, you can look at the moon and there it is. It's never going to change. It sort of follows you around. So I think it's a very potent thing for the human psyche.
It's the first thing I looked at with a telescope that my parents bought me. They bought me a little 3-inch refractor when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And the owner of the telescope shop took my wooden tripod legs, painted them black, and then took white paint and speckled it like little stars. And I'll just never forget it. But the first thing I looked at was the moon, of course.
Uh-huh.
And gosh, Eric, I mean, I had never seen anything so intriguing in all my life. I mean, I must have been about 10 or 11 years old, and you're looking at the moon with this telescope much better than you could with your naked eye, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, looking at those craters and stuff, it was just fascinating, and I was hooked right after that.
I mean, you go kind of through people who have had that experience with little telescopes. I mean, that's the experience that, you know, Galileo had, and Robert Hooke and other astronomers.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
1600s. There's something about seeing something three times bigger. All of a sudden, everything that you thought was one way is richer, and the more we look with more and more powerful instruments, the richer it all becomes.
And I looked at Saturn and saw the rings, and that got me too. But hold on, Eric, we're going to take a quick break, then we'll come back and talk more about your work when the Earth had two moons. Also, did we have a binary star system in the solar system too? We'll check in. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Eric, and I bet Bill from Hartford, the amateur astronomer, will give us a call. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We will take calls next hour with our planetary expert, Eric S. Fogg, and his latest book is called When the Earth Had Two Moons. The subtitle is also important, Eric. Cannibal Planets, Icy Giants, Dirty Comets, Dreadful Orbits, and the Origins of the Night Sky. Let's go through some of those. What are cannibal planets?
Well, cannibal planets, that was sort of a possible alternate title for the book. When you look at the Earth that we all live on, modern theory is that it was built when other planets came together. So the Earth swallows up these other planets. If you want to wind the Wayback Machine back to 4.6 billion years ago, before there were planets, the Sun had just been born, big pile of gas and dust in the universe from a nebula. Falls onto itself gravitationally, and then enough matter gets into one spot that it heats up, becomes a star, and then you start to make the planets. None of the traditional theories worked of how to make the planets, and what we've ended up with after a century of trying to figure this out is there must have been about 30 or 40 or maybe 100 planets orbiting the Sun.
Wow.
Yeah, and so and then these would orbit. Gracefully for some time, but when you think about it, each planet, if it has a close encounter with another one, it'll knock its orbit around a little bit, and pretty soon things get a little messed up. And after you wind the clock forward now, 10 million years, 20 million years, 30, 40, 50, about 100 million years, during those first 100 million years, you had those 30 planets gobbling each other up until you end up with the four terrestrial planets we have today.
Eric, let's take spirituality out of this equation for just a moment. But, when you look at the universe and the stars and the planets and all this incredible stuff, and then our complexity of life on this planet, I got to ask you, as a planetary scientist, what do you think life is? I mean, what is this? I mean, it just seems like it's so out of place with the rest of the universe.
It's, what is life? I mean, it sort of gets to the question of when people say, is there life elsewhere in the cosmos? I think most scientists will raise their hand right away saying yes, but they'd be mostly talking about microbes, little small bugs, single cellular organisms,
little bacterium and stuff like that.
Little bacteria. We've never been able to synthesize these things or do this. Life has to start with some miraculous concoction of the right molecules doing the right things. But I'd say the basic definition of life is some kind of a, self-organized process that replicates itself. And, I'm not a biologist, so biologists out there will probably laugh at my definition. But then you kind of go up the scale and you have sentient life, and sentient life would be like a chicken or a pig or a worm, something that can make decisions. And then you have what we call sapient life, and sapient is Latin for wisdom, and that would be, I guess we're wise, and, people
sometimes.
And then, maybe you would keep going up this scale, maybe to some creatures out there in the somewhere in the galaxy, we're about as sophisticated as chickens. I feel like we're on the cusp, and a lot of astronomers feel like we're on the cusp of being able to answer the question of, are we alone in the universe? It feels like the timing has come in terms of the types of instruments we have now, the amount of intense scrutiny all the data are getting. Massive radio telescopes are now pointing directly at these planets that have been discovered around us, listening to see if we can hear any what we call techno signature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like any sort of radio stations or laser beams that they might have, using for various things. And you mentioned the Dyson spheres, alien civilizations that might be out there. It has the feeling to me. If you go back in time to 1992. We didn't know about any other planets other than our solar system. There was...
And that's not too long ago.
No. It was like, in fairly recent memory. And I remember it quite well, this sort of scientific skepticism. And today it seems remarkable, right? I mean, it seems kind of arrogant to think that we'd be the only star of all the 100 million... billion, trillion stars that are out there, we'd be the only one that has planets. But, you know, skeptics are skeptics. And then in 1993, astronomers, they just got the Nobel Prize for this. Two Swiss astronomers, they discovered the first, what we call an exoplanet. And these were the easy ones to find. These would be planets the size of Jupiter, orbiting about... 10 times closer to their star than Mercury orbits the sun. So these would be giant planets that whip around their star every 4 or 5 days.
Jeez.
Getting roasted and baked by the sun. And these, nobody had ever seen these before. And we actually, I should preface that by, we don't actually see the planets. We see signatures that they're orbiting their star. And then there was this space telescope called Kepler that was launched in the, I think it was 2005, and it ended the mission around 2010. So it operated for about 5 years, and it did one thing only. It stared at a pretty random patch of the sky, didn't blink. It had a extremely high pixel count CCD, just like, your best camera, but, on steroids. And just stared at these stars without moving and without blinking for years. And then if any of those stars had planets, and if those stars happened to have the planets in the same plane so that they would pass in front of their star, it would be like a little mini eclipse, and the star would get a little bit dimmer. It was a little bit of a gamble, but after 3 years of operation, suddenly we had 3,000-4,000 new planets, including some that are potentially kind of Earth-like. And I think that's mind-blowing, that we've gone from a period where we were hard-pressed to think for sure that there were planets to now, to put a number on it, there's probably 100 billion trillion planets.
And there's got to be life. It's got to be teeming with life out there, Eric.
I put on my skeptic hat.
Just go with percents,
Yeah.
Frank Drake, the Drake equation.
Yeah.
It's got to be out there.
Yeah, the one thing we don't know is, does the development of this little molecule, like the DNA or the RNA, does that take some kind of an event that's one in a quintillion?
Right. Or is it easy if you have the temperature, the water, and the right complexity?
Yeah. So I feel we're kind of like, when it comes to life in the universe, I think we might kind of be like we were with the existence of planets back in the 90s. Right now, all the scientists are being very skeptical. It's kind of our job. And then, if some data comes and we get some definite signature of life around some other planet, suddenly the whole world's going to change. We'll know that we're in a universe that's teeming with life, and there's a difference between believing it, which I actually believe that, and knowing it.
Would you say, I knew it, when they come out with that? You wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'd be really interested in what the human societal response would be.
And the life could take form. It could be like dolphins or whales or something. Who knows?
And the kinds of things we grew up on Star Trek and things like that. And some of the things in Star Trek end up proving true. Like now we all have iPads and we all have cell phones.
That's right.
you know. And then other things where all the planets have these creatures that look just like ours, that's probably not true. That's a production cost thing. You can't have, you know, you want to go have them put on an alien suit and get on with the show. But, you know, what would be the kind of life? And what fascinates me is the question of what would be the most advanced life that's out there.
Yeah, exactly. But
you know, we have these brains that were developed around 1 million years ago. We started evolving quite a bit, hominids. And suddenly our brains doubled in size about 1 million years ago, maybe 2 million to 1 million years ago. And this kind of coincided with striking flint to make tools out of them and sort of getting this more complex interaction with the universe. And then also the ability to kill animals more efficiently, to feed ourselves. And so we kind of grew these brains. But when you think about it, the brain's a pretty burdensome thing. It uses about 30% of your body's energy, so you got to eat 30% more. It's this fragile thing on top of your head that you got to take care of. You know, so what were the evolutionary advantages? I'm not too clear, other than that we're smart and we can do a lot of things, but it's limited by our ability to move around. So when you think of what's the smartest creature in the universe, it might be this big, gigantic sponge-like organism at the bottom of some alien ocean that has a brain the size of a house.
That's saying, what am I doing down here? You know what's so amazing about life, too, though? In order to exist the way we do here on this planet, you needed eyes to see, you needed a nose to breathe, you needed a mouth to eat, and we have all these things. I mean, what kind of a great designer would come up with this?
It's, you know, I'm grateful for all those things. But
it can't be an accident.
You know, I don't think it can be. Well, the one counter to that is, you know, and I'm not an expert on biology, but, you know, people talk about how the squid has an eyeball that's very similar to the human eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
If you dissect a squid's eye and look at it, it operates the exact same principle as the human eye. And it has a cornea, it has a, and so the question is, you know, why would two completely different paths develop the same kind of eyes? You know, it sort of depends what you need to get by, what gives you an advantage being able to see. But I think there are certain designs that are the most efficient, that if you believe in evolution, you know, we evolve towards those kinds of best situations. Like, there's no three-legged mammals, right? You either have two-legged mammals or four-legged mammals, probably because, you know, a couple of times a three-legged mammal gets born and it has a hard time running around and doesn't make it. But taking that to the extreme, when you start to think of alien visitors and other coming and visiting us, would they look like us? If they came from a different planet that had a completely different type of environment, like if they came from an ocean planet, then I think you'd have these dolphin creatures, for instance.
Right. And unfortunately for the dolphins, if they had arms and a thumb, they could really be something, because I think they might be the smartest mammals out there.
Don't they have bigger brains than we do?
Yep, they sure do.
Yeah.
And they're more compassionate than most humans.
They tolerate my daughter. I know that.
You know, yeah. You ever see a dolphin attack somebody?
No, they help you out.
They do. Exactly. We're constantly making new discoveries, Eric. What's out there that just rings you? And, you know, it's one of those great discoveries that maybe hasn't been publicized too much.
Well, for me, I'm waiting for the next great landing, because the things that have been most memorable to me as a scientist is when I see an image from the surface of another planet.
Yeah.
And I think it was in 1999 or 2000 when maybe it was like 2005, the Huygens lander. Most people probably haven't heard of it, but the Cassini mission to Saturn, when it flew by Titan. Now, Titan is a gigantic moon of Saturn. It's the largest moon in the solar system if you include the extent of its atmosphere.
It's like a planet almost, isn't it?
It's bigger than Mercury. It's bigger than Pluto. It's twice the size of the moon almost. So it's this. I would call it a planet. I don't think we need to parse language too much. I'd say Titan is a planet. It has lakes the size of the Great Lakes. It has rain. The rain is made out of methane and propane.
What's its heat source from within?
It's a big question. It's kind of an open question, because when planets form, they encase all the stuff they were made of, and a lot of the stuff that they were made of is radioactive. A lot of your listeners probably have radon detectors to warn about radon gas building up in their house. What is radon gas? Well, that's just if your house is built on top of granite. Granite has uranium in the rock, and it breaks down, and it releases a little bit of energy, which we don't care too much about. But it also releases radon gas, which can be toxic. In the case of Titan orbiting Saturn, it might have some radioactive elements inside that give it a heat source. It also, orbiting Saturn, it has a slightly eccentric orbit, which means it comes a little bit closer and then a little bit farther and then a little bit closer to Saturn every time it orbits.
How did it get captured?
Well, the Saturn system is such a big, weird mystery. I'd say the Saturn system is the thing that, if I had to pick one planet to study, I'd say that's the system to try to figure out, because it has so many puzzles interconnected. The theory for how giant planets get their moons is one of kind of like a mini solar system. The giant planet forms kind of like the sun formed. The gas and the dust in the disk around the sun starts to coalesce into a blob, and that blob has maybe 100 times the mass of the Earth. Saturn's about 100 times the mass of the Earth. And so you have this enormous ball of gas, dust, ice, rock, forming a big gas giant. It's not big enough to create enough heat and pressure to ignite with fusion, which is what makes the sun so bright, but it becomes this big ball. And then around it are these disks of dust and gas, and those accumulate to form the satellites. We think it's a common process, which is very important, actually, because if you're looking for habitable worlds, places where there might be life, in our solar system, there's two candidates besides the Earth where we are really interested in looking for life. One is on Mars, because it's the most Earth-like. Has the most Earth-like features, and there was all this evidence of water flowing on the surface. And then you have these moons around the giant planets, Titan around Saturn and Europa around Jupiter. And these are heated from the inside, and they're coated in ice. So the heat source is probably caused by this the tide that rises and falls and rises and falls every time it orbits the giant planet. And that can provide a lot of heat. It's kind of like bending a paperclip repeatedly. It'll sort of create frictional heating inside the planet. That can last for billions and billions of years. And when you think about it, it's almost like a miraculous recipe for an ocean that would last forever.
Right.
You encase it in ice, and it's shielded from radiation. It's shielded from all the nastiness of space. And then maybe 3 or 4 miles deep, suddenly you have an ocean that's at the same temperature as Earth's ocean. The only thing it's missing is you don't get any sunlight, but deep on Earth's ocean, you don't have any sunlight either.
Stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls with the professor in a moment. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, the book we're talking about, When the Earth Had Two Moons. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.